lads that we were, we quickly figured out there was good money to be made if the right methods were used. For example, the funeral home guys were the cheapest SOBs in town. I mean, these guys would scoop up loose change in an outhouse. Many times they would forget to provide the saintly altar boys with the expected gratuity for performing the funeral ceremony with dignity and compassion. On occasions like these, I, having control of the incense pot, might become just a tad bit exuberant with it, causing large clouds of smoke to form over the grieving congregation. Of course, the priest would shoot me a dirty look, but the message was sent: the living must be taken care of. Likewise, weddings were cash cows, but the mooing could be loud or soft depending on the groom and the best man. They were the ones who tipped the priest and the two altar boys who assisted at the mass. One of the altar boys, always me, held the gold plate on which the rings were placed. If the gratuity was smallish, a small mention might be made of my sprained wrist and the kind of pain I would be enduring during the ceremony. Of course, the wrist could be steadier with a little inducement. It always came, and Father O'Malley usually got a few more bucks as well. I never had any trouble with the priests, and a few of them were actually good guys. All the altar boys went to Father Ellard for confession because he was the local prison chaplain, and after what he heard in there, we figured our peccadillos were insignificant. Father Ellard was also very, very old and couldn't really hear much. Obviously, this was a win-win situation, and even dastardly sins, like making out with some girl, usually drew a simple penance consisting of a few Hail Marys or Our Fathers. And we all knew what priests to avoid. One named Father Tierney was a mean guy, and if you hit your sister or something, the guy could have you saying a couple of rosaries on a sunny day. Rosary prayers take about 20 minutes to say if you slur the words. Tierney was also a boozer, and you could smell his brand right through the confessional screen. One time he really got on my case over an apple I threw at a car. I didn't even hit the car, but Tierney was going wild. "Do you realize this is the devil's work?" he asked. "Sure, Father," I said. "He's zeroing in on me and some serial killers." That's what I should have said. Instead, I thought an evil thought about Father Tierney, thereby racking up a new sin, even as I was getting rid of the old ones. It wasn't easy being Catholic. As I got older, I saw differences between our altar boy crew and some of the neighborhood guys who had no formal religion in their lives. The differences came down on two fronts. First, in my Catholic grammar school, there were constant programs designed to help people and promote generosity. Even though my friends and I often mocked these attempts, the lessons were not lost on most of us. The 60 kids in my class at St. Bridget's School looked out for one another. Intense conflict was rare. We did not engage in ferocious fights like the ones we saw across the street at the public school. Generosity was part of the curriculum, while the brainwashing nuns pounded on us to think of others before ourselves. One quick anecdote about the nuns. In sixth grade, I got into a fight with one of the teacher's pets, a guy named Tommy Massey. It was just a little pushing and shoving, but because I was an everyday offender and Massey was on the fast track to heaven, I took the fall. My sentence was to spend 3 days in solitary confinement in the nuns' convent. That's the place where they live. I was given busy work and left alone all day long. The only supervision came from a housebound nun named Sister Gerardo, who was 99 if she was a day. She was supposed to make sure I did my work and didn't steal anything. I was not real pleased about the situation and plotted my revenge. On the last day of my suspension, I snuck out of my assigned room and saw that Sister Gerardo had entered the land of Nod. She was actually snoring, a sound I never imagined could emanate from a nun. Seizing the moment, I crept out of the room and quickly mounted the stairs into the living quarters of a half dozen sisters. Now, this was a major mortal sin, but it was too late. I was there. The doors of all the rooms were open, and I remember everything was very neat. I couldn't tell which nun had which room, but I had to make a statement. So I walked into one of the rooms, removed some nun stuff, and put it under the bed in another room. I then tiptoed back downstairs. Of course, I told all my classmates about it the next day, but something very strange happened. Nobody believed me, and I obviously couldn't prove it. So I did this bold thing, hoping for massive adulation from my friends, and nobody cared. And not only that, For the next month, every time the teacher called my name, I jumped up in a paranoid frenzy. It was agony, and obviously a punishment from God. But interestingly, I was never called on it, and if I had been, I was all set to blame Sister Jurado. The second advantage we in Catholic school had was a structure born of tradition. There was always something going on. Our days featured adventurous stories about heroic martyrs and missionaries such as St. Patrick driving the snakes out of Ireland. There were Christmas pageants, Easter parades, and movies about miracles. As I came to admire the legacy of my religion, it was actually fun to learn about villains like Judas and Herod. We all admired heroes like St. Peter, who was crucified upside down at his own request because he felt he wasn't worthy of dying the same way Jesus did. During my teenage years, being a practicing Catholic really paid off. I was kind of awkward around girls because of the occasion of sin it represented and envied some of the public school guys who were operators. But I didn't envy them when they got their girlfriends pregnant and had to get married in their teens. That happened to my cousin Eddie. He was always considered a cool guy at his public high school. He would die in his early 40s from acute alcoholism after struggling with the bottle his entire adult life. That's not to say that self-destructive and foolish behavior didn't visit Catholic school kids as well. It did, but not in the same degree and not with me. Well, at least the self-destructive stuff didn't happen. When drugs swept through my neighborhood, I wouldn't dare and didn't care. I instinctively knew that they were bad on every level. But my public school friend and chess partner, Michael K., didn't have the same inhibition or point of view. He became addicted to heroin. He also died in his 40s. My saving grace, pun intended, is that I understood at a very young age that my religion looked out for me and that Jesus was a good man. At the same time, I never ever tried to convert non-believers and respected the rights of every person to hold other beliefs. Although I have to admit that we Catholics got a little teed off when half of the neighborhood stickball team had to leave in the fifth inning to attend Hebrew school. Something about the boundaries imposed by my parents and my religion saved me. Many of my more secular childhood friends are dead or emotionally destroyed. Most working-class neighborhoods have a high failure rate. With my genes, had I not been born a Catholic, my life would have been much tougher. My religion, not any specific priest or nun, looked out for me because I took what was good and positive about it and used it as a shield, and I still do to this day. Even so, I would not call myself a holy guy. I'm a sinner, but I do cast stones anyway. That will make my meeting with St. Peter very interesting. Perhaps the biggest stone I'm hurling right now is in the direction of the secularists, because even though my upbringing was rough-hewn, kids today have much more intense temptations to deal with. Beaver Cleaver has been replaced by Snoop Dogg. Children are under siege. With no moral shield, millions of American kids will fail just like my cousin Eddie and my pal Michael. The secularists don't care. They want children to be at the mercy of a materialistic society and a greedy media. They want kids to rely solely on parents who are often irresponsible and self-destructive themselves. Right now, all we can do is pray for the kids and fight the secularists hand to hand. And if you want some empirical evidence to back up that opinion, listen to this. A study of college students seeking psychological counseling has found that their emotional difficulties are far more complex and more severe than those observed in the past. Researchers at Kansas State University studied students from 1989 to 2001 and concluded that those seeking help for depression doubled during that time period. Also, the percentage of students taking some type of psychiatric medication had increased twofold. That trend is not limited just to Kansas. In a 2002 national survey, more than 80% of 274 directors of counseling centers said they thought the number of students with severe psychological disorders had increased over the previous 5 years. Now, you can argue all day long why this is happening, but I'll give you one huge reason. Many young Americans simply do not have a force in their lives that can relieve their emotional suffering. They are drifting away from our religious traditions, and religion can be that force, at least in part. If you are able to believe that a higher power will look out for you and will balance bad times with good times, your stress level will not get out of control. Religious faith is generally bad for the shrink business, but honest mental health workers know what's going on. People just don't seem to have the resources to draw upon emotionally to the degree they used to, the director of counseling at the University of Nebraska, Dr. Robert Pomeroy, told the New York Times. What would once have been a difficult patch for someone is now a full-blown crisis, says the doctor. The rise in dysfunction parallels the rise in secularism, no question about it. There's one more aspect of the religion controversy that needs to be addressed, the selective favoring of a certain religion in the name of diversity. This usually goes on beneath the radar screen, but an incident at the University of North Carolina blew the cover off this trend. I do believe the Founding Fathers were absolutely correct in demanding that no public authority in the USA favor a specific religion. So I was distressed to hear that in the fall of 2002, the administration at UNC was going to require all incoming freshmen to read a book entitled Approaching the Quran, The Early Revelations. The book is a sanitized version of Quran philosophy, concentrating on lyrical stories and poetic lore. It's a very interesting book, but there's no way it should be mandatory reading in any public school. Just imagine the outcry if any school demanded the students read Bible highlights or nice stuff from the Torah. I mean, the ACLU would be setting itself on fire in protest, figuratively speaking, of course. But the ACLU was strangely mute when the UNC issued its reading list. So what was really going on here? Well, the backlash from 9/11 was hurting many law-abiding Islamic Americans, and the philosophy of diversity was taking some hits. So the University of North Carolina decided to set a proactive example and require students to read a book favorable to Islam. The intent was good, but it was a direct violation of the separation concept because it required students to learn about the positive aspects of a specific religion while ignoring the negative aspects. That's religious advocacy, not intellectual discipline. And that's not allowed in a publicly funded university in the USA. The force behind the Islamic reading selection was UNC professor Dr. Robert Kirkpatrick. On July 10, 2002, he entered the no-spin zone on the O'Reilly Factor. I've condensed some of our debate, but the main points are these. O'Reilly, the problem here is that this is indoctrination of religion. Kirkpatrick, no. It has nothing to do with that. It's a text that studies the poetic structure of the Quran and seeks to explain why it has such an effect on 2 billion people in the world. O'Reilly, UNC never gave incoming freshmen a book on the Bible to read. Kirkpatrick, we assume that most people coming to the University of North Carolina are already familiar with both the Old and New Testaments. O'Reilly, but if you did do that, there'd be an outcry all over the country. The professor had no answer for that. Soon after, under pressure from the North Carolina legislature, UNC dropped the book from its required reading list. Approaching the Quran became an optional reading assignment, as it should have been all along. And I'll go one step further. If the book was mandatory reading in a theology or history class, I wouldn't have any problem with it. But forcing all incoming freshmen to read any book praising a specific religion does violate the mandate that public universities have to live by in order to receive our tax dollars. There's an interesting side note to the controversy. As I said, the ACLU was MIA during the UNC brouhaha. Oh, I love all those initials. Also, most other media didn't cover the story as aggressively as we did. As part of our analysis, we rejected the argument that reading the Quran book would help us get to know the world the 9/11 killers inhabited. Number one, I don't think the revelations of the Prophet Muhammad have anything to do with homicide and terrorism. And secondly, I reject the argument that you have to digest a book of poetry and religious interpretation in order to know your enemy. I said this to Professor Kirkpatrick, quote, as a UNC freshman, I wouldn't read the book. And if I were going to the university in 1941, I wouldn't have read Mein Kampf either. Kirkpatrick asked why. Because it's tripe, I answered. The next day, a number of Muslim websites wrote that I compared the Quran to Mein Kampf. the usual vile propaganda some of these sites spew out. What can you do? Should be obvious to clear-thinking Americans that spirituality and Judeo-Christian philosophy were main ingredients in the dense fabric of ideas that became the Constitution. Simply put, historical revisionists and anti-religious fanatics are tearing down what the founders relied upon, moral clarity. And the courts are allowing them to get away with it, proving that the courts are not looking out for you, the American citizen. As far as your personal religious conviction, that is completely up to you. But I will say this. Used in the correct way, religion can be a force that makes your life more worthwhile. It can make the bad times bearable and the good times more satisfying. Spirituality looks out for you because it brings you out of yourself and into a realm where the welfare of other people becomes as important as your own. And as we've discussed previously, that kind of worldview will allow you to build relationships with people who will indeed look out for you, even as you are looking out for them. Chapter 6, The Holy War. War, children, it's just a shout away. The Rolling Stones, Gimme Shelter. On March 20, 2003, the day the USA and Britain attacked Iraq, the Gallup poll people asked this question. Do you approve or disapprove of the United States' decision to go to war with Iraq? The answer, approve, 76%. Disapprove, 20%. No opinion, 4%. Gallup also asked if the USA should have waited longer before initiating the military action. The response to the question, should the war have begun when it did? Yes, 70%. Waited longer, 27%. Don't know, 3%. Overwhelmingly, Americans backed the action against Saddam. Yet on the same day, March 20th, ABC News and NBC News devoted a substantial amount of their evening newscasts to both domestic and foreign war protesters. CBS did not, completely ignoring them on the Rather broadcast. World News Tonight with Peter Jennings spent 4 minutes and 40 seconds reporting on war dissent. NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw topped that. It spent 4 minutes 45 seconds on war protests and another 1 minute 35 seconds on war objections by some Democrats. Neither Jennings nor Brokaw spent 1 second on the 76% of Americans who thought the war was the right action to take. Dan Rather was smarter. He focused entirely on the war itself and stayed away from the policy debate. However, he also failed to mention the amazing amount of support Americans were giving the Bush administration at the start of the war. If the goal of the network newscast is to give Americans a balanced look at vital stories, a strong argument can be made that the opinions of the vast majority of Americans was blatantly ignored by the national newscast on the day a monumental event occurred. But why? The reasons are twofold. First, the visuals of protesters running amok are much more compelling than the images of everyday Americans sitting in their living rooms cheering on American troops. Protests mean action, and TV news loves action. But the most compelling reason for the overexposure the protesters received is that there is sympathy for their cause in many American newsrooms. That sympathy is based on the internationalist view of the world that some in the elite media embrace. In their eyes, the USA should engage with other nations of the world, no matter how corrupt or tyrannical, in a collegial fashion. What's wrong with that? Simple. That philosophy does not look out for you, the everyday American, because it puts your security and concerns on an equal footing with the concerns of those abroad. And as we all learned the hard way on 9/11 and in the run-up to the Iraq War, some foreign countries don't seem to have the welfare and security of Americans at the top of their dance card. Does France? Does Saudi Arabia? Does Russia? Since I can't read minds, it would be unfair of me to label Mr. Jennings, Mr. Brokaw, and Mr. Rather anything other than experienced professionals. Because it is impossible to know the thought process of any newscast anchor or producer, any analysis of their motivations would be speculative and unfair. I can report only what these men presented to the nation on the first day of the war. To be candid, The Factor covered the protests as well, but not as the fighting in Iraq commenced, and our coverage of the dissenters was certainly far more skeptical as far as their motives were concerned, than what the Network News reported. Walter Cronkite, in my opinion, epitomizes the international point of view that some elite media types embrace. Uncle Walter, who is still well-respected around the country, made no secret of his loathing for how the Bush administration handled the Iraq War. So I filed this analysis, which was printed in hundreds of newspapers across the country. Quote, "No surprise, ideologues on both the left and the right are screaming that the media coverage of the Iraq War is slanted away from their beliefs. The sound and the fury of the partisans is predictable and not very important. Because there are so many media outlets that the sheer amount of information Americans can potentially get obliterates any narrow agenda an individual journalist might have. As far as TV news is concerned, the repertorial flow of information is occasionally tainted by a biased remark, but this is not a serious problem because, again, there's just so much verbiage. However, there is a philosophical divide among the broadcast anchor people, and this you should know about. In a speech at Drew University last week, Walter Cronkite harshly criticized the war and the Bush administration, saying, quote, "The arrogance of our spokespeople, even the president himself, has been exceptional, and it seems to me they, other countries, have taken great umbrage at that. We have told them what they must do. It is a pretty dark doctrine." Unquote. Now, it seems to me that the 83-year-old former CBS anchor is minimizing the fact that the Bush administration did try to work through the UN to disarm Iraq. And while it is true that many in the Bush administration could do with a Dale Carnegie seminar, it's also true that America was royally screwed in the UN Security Council by our so-called allies. Ask Colin Powell what he thinks of the way the French have conducted themselves. But the real problem with Cronkite's analysis is that he looks at the situation from an international point of view, while the president and some other newsmen, including your humble correspondent, look at the Iraq conflict from an American perspective. Walter Cronkite is an internationalist. That is, he sees other countries in the world as being on an equal footing with America when vital situations arise. Few other national TV anchormen are internationalists as well, in varying degrees. But there are major problems with covering the American war on terror from an internationalist point of view. As a journalist, I want to be fair, but I also want President Bush to put the protection of Americans above the economic and political concerns of other countries. Call me a jingoist, but your family security means more to me than Gerhard Schroeder's political career. I understand that some countries are angry that Mr. Bush rejected the Kyoto Environmental Agreement and, like Bill Clinton, I feel their pain. But not nearly as much as the pain I felt watching 3,000 of my countrymen die on 9/11. So if some egomaniacal leader like Jacques Chirac is going to protect Saddam Hussein because he doesn't like Bush's style, I'm going to knock Chirac hard. But Uncle Walter doesn't see it that way. He sees the war on Iraq as preemptive and unnecessary because it doesn't have worldwide validation. Mr. Cronkite believes that the agendas of other countries should be considered when making decisions about the defense of Americans, even when those agendas are based on greed and petty politics. I strongly disagree. The truth is that Walter Cronkite stood by and said little while a Vietnam War raged out of control in the 60s. Finally, he confronted the lies and deceit the Johnson administration perpetuated on the American public, but Cronkite's conversion came very late in that deadly game. When President Clinton bombed Milosevic's Belgrade, circumventing the UN and ignoring the objections of France and Russia, Cronkite said nothing publicly. Maybe he didn't notice the bombing was preemptive and that many nations disapproved. So while Mr. Cronkite is an internationalist, he seems to be a selective one. But even if he were consistent in giving equal weight to the policies of other countries vis-a-vis the security of the USA, he would be wrong. American journalists commenting about the war on terror are obligated to inform their listeners or readers if they see the world as a level playing field. If Walter Cronkite believes that the French view of the terror threat is just as valid as the American view, then he needs to clearly state that so that people like me can challenge him. Look at it this way. In covering World War II, the young Cronkite would never have given the Spanish view of the war the same weight as the American view. Franco's Spain was sympathetic to Hitler. As a responsible reporter, Cronkite could not have possibly done that. Yet in the war on terror, Cronkite and others like him won a world consensus on how to deal with villains like Saddam. That is truly misguided and might even be dangerous to the health of Americans. But Francisco Franco would love it. The column you just heard angered some in the elite media. Tough. What I wrote was and is true. We have a bunch of very powerful people in the press who give moral equivalencies to foreign countries and even to organizations and philosophies that are bent on harming the USA. That ecumenical view is simply awful. One final word about Mr. Cronkite, who shortly after that controversy had to disengage himself from a medical product because he was endorsing it for money. It was an embarrassing episode for him, but I didn't deal with it on the Factor. That's because I have nothing against Walter Cronkite and have no idea what happened in the commercial brouhaha, which also featured CBS's Morley Safer and Aaron Brown of CNN. My beef with Cronkite concerned a policy opinion he made. I simply disagreed with it. And just because he's Walter Cronkite doesn't mean I can't call him out. People like to think that if you disagree with someone's opinion, you're attacking them. That's just dumb. Cronkite is a broadcasting legend and deserves his status. But the ground he walks on is not sacred, and he was wrong about the Iraq War. And perhaps the tongue-lashing was good for Uncle Walter. 2 months later, he announced that he himself was going to write a syndicated newspaper column and outed himself as a liberal. I was shocked, I tell you, just shocked. My support for the removal of Saddam Hussein was based on logic and data. In the months leading up to the war, I simply tossed out emotion and examined the facts. 1. In 1991, Saddam invaded Kuwait, but was forced out by a coalition led by the USA. In the process, 293 Americans died. 2. As part of that peace agreement that Saddam signed to end the first Gulf War, he agreed to give up all of his weapons of mass destruction and allow UN weapons inspectors to verify his compliance. 3. Saddam then proceeded to violate 18 UN mandates to disarm, and in 98, refused to allow the weapons inspectors any further access inside Iraq. Finally, more than 4 years later, at the urging of the United States, UN Resolution 1441 was passed, demanding that Saddam produce his WMDs immediately or face serious consequences. 4. After Saddam defied 1441, the UN refused to confront Saddam militarily. The reasons were primarily political and economic. As we now know, France, Russia, and Germany were making millions of dollars doing business, some of it illegal, with Saddam. The USA and Britain complained bitterly, but to no avail. 5. After September 11th, the U.S. embarked on a worldwide defensive strategy to hunt down terrorists and their enablers wherever a situation posed a perceived danger. Saddam was certainly a terrorist enabler, giving sanctuary to killers like Abu Nidal and Abu Abbas and training Hamas executioners. With his self-admitted stocks of anthrax and other impossible-to-detect chemical and biological weapons, the evil dictator was in a position to supply various terrorist groups with doomsday substances. You'll remember that just a few envelopes dipped in anthrax nearly shut down the U.S. government in the days after 9/11. So, using logical thinking, I came to the conclusions that Saddam had violated the Gulf War Treaty, was a potential danger to the USA, could not be contained by Hans Blix and his crew of UN weapons inspectors, and was a psychopathic murderer who had to be confronted in order to prevent any further atrocities. Before Al-Qaeda hit us in 9/11, the USA could rationalize that allowing monsters like Saddam to remain in power could not be at the sole discretion of America. After all, the world is full of brutal dictators, and the USA is not mandated to remove them all from power. But with fanatical Muslims dedicated to using any and all methods in order to kill American civilians, it would have been irresponsible for an American president to allow the United Nations to allow Saddam, a man with a huge list of undetermined WMDs in his arsenal, to continue his rule. What did our people die for in 91? If peace treaties are worth nothing, then this world will soon descend into chaos. I firmly believe that had Al Gore been elected in 2000, he would have done the exact same thing that President Bush did. Certainly his running mate, Senator Joseph Lieberman, fully supported the war against Iraq. My support for the war drew the ire of publications like the New York Times and the LA Times, perhaps the most ideological of all the elite media. Both publications falsely accused me of being a political partisan because I felt the forced removal of Saddam was the right thing to do. Of course, my analysis of the situation had nothing to do with partisan politics. It had everything to do with justice and protecting the American people. I also stated on many occasions that I respect honest dissent. For that reason, those who opposed the war on principle and not from anti-Bush ideology were given a fair hearing on the factor. The actor Mike Farrell had 8 minutes in which to put forth his point of view, and I challenged it. It was an illuminating debate. And in the end, Mr. Farrell said that no matter what the outcome in Iraq, he would not admit President Bush was right. And of course, it is Farrell's right to state that. However, it is a wise person who leaves some room for the possibility that he or she is wrong. More than a few anti-war protesters use their opposition as the occasion to take partisan shots and promote a variety of other causes. Even worse, some anti-war protesters tried to take the high moral ground, which I found incredibly offensive. All sincerely held beliefs should be respected, especially when the issue of war had so many unanswered questions. The brutal truth is that the only people who possessed absolute moral certainty in this conflict were the ones who died for their country. The military heroes and heroines alone held the high moral ground, and nobody should ever forget it. The moral question surrounding the war became even thornier when Pope John Paul II weighed in by calling the conflict unjust. The pontiff, obviously a man of peace, openly objected to the coalition's invasion of Iraq. This is not meant as a cheap shot, but I wish the Pope had brought the same kind of moral passion to the priest pedophilia scandal we discussed earlier. Anyway, in response to the Pope's position on Iraq, I wrote this in March 2003. It is fairly easy to understand why France, Germany, China, and Russia oppose removing Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein by force. Those countries are doing profitable business with Saddam, and all of them would like to see American power diminished. But Pope John Paul is another matter. His opposition to military action is understandable in theory, but troubling in practice. John Paul has sent his emissary, Pio Cardinal Laghi, to tell President Bush that attacking Iraq would be unjust and immoral. That's like sending Sister Mary Teresa to tell Eminem to stop cursing. The president is firmly convinced that Saddam is an evil man with murder on his mind. Short of Jesus appearing in the Oval Office with an opposing point of view, Bush is not going to change his opinion. The Catholic Church embraces the tradition of just war. That is, any use of force must be accompanied by clear and convincing evidence that only force will solve a situation that is both threatening and immoral. And since there is the possibility that UN weapons inspectors might be able to restrain Saddam, the Pope believes there are still options to war. The problem with that argument is faith, pardon the pun. The Pope is putting his faith in a system of inspections that very well might fail. If that happens, and even a portion of Saddam's unaccounted for 8,500 liters of anthrax is used against people, a worldwide catastrophe would ensue. The Pope does not answer questions, so it's impossible to know what he thinks about that possibility. We also don't know how John Paul squares keeping Saddam in power, considering his murderous past. It's one thing for the Vatican to condemn Saddam's gassing of the Kurds, mass murder and rape in Kuwait, and the funding of suicide bombing expeditions. It's quite another to prevent those things. So what are America's 65 million Catholics supposed to do? Theologically, the Pope is on firm ground. Humanistically, he is one of the many Saddam enablers. If the nations of the world would unite against evil thugs like Saddam and the insanity of countries like North Korea, deadly situations would be solved and the world would be a better, safer place. But the world will not unite against evil, and the Pope does not call for that practical unification. Instead, he calls for peace. Does he really believe Saddam and North Korea's Kim Jong-il are listening? The Catholic Church teaches tranquilitas ordinis, the peace of order, which is supposed to be imposed by legal and political means. But as the world has seen, Osama bin Laden, Adolf Hitler, and yes, Saddam Hussein, have not been bullish on the peace of order. Instead, they have embraced the practice of violent chaos. As a loyal Catholic, I'm glad the Pope is praying for America and for peace. I pray his prayers will work a miracle and Saddam will be removed from power without bloodshed. But if that miracle is not forthcoming, this Catholic does not have faith that Saddam will not use his outlawed anthrax somewhere down the line. And so, to prevent the mass death that took place in Europe and Asia while another Pope was praying 60 years ago, I support the moral quest of removing a dangerous killer from power. God forgive me. Endorsing the war against Saddam did not mean I was pro-war, as the simpletons who want to demonize their policy opponents would have you believe. Up until the last minute, I believed and was praying for a possible scenario whereby the coward Saddam, along with his two thug sons, would abdicate. That certainly would have been the best solution for the world. It is certainly true that the Fox News Channel launched its war coverage with less skepticism than any of the other broadcast news services. Led by the Factors Analysis, FNC, wanted the USA and its satellites to win the fight. There was never any question about that. While ABC News and others openly doubted the righteousness and practicality of the action, FNC thought the opposite, a viewpoint that was well within ethical editorial bounds. Our reporters, both embedded and otherwise, were told not to strike an editorial tone, and most didn't. But FNC analysts, including me, did provide mostly pro-American opinion. This approach brought vicious attacks on us by some who did not agree with that opinion. But it also brought record-high ratings led by The Factor, which soared into the top position among all cable news programs for the duration of the war. In other words, the 70% of American people who believed the conflict was just were those who voted with their remote control devices. Predictably, that response drove our critics even crazier. Some of our competitors screamed that Fox and O'Reilly pandered to patriotism or carried water for the Bush administration. But the true reason we destroyed CNN and NBC in the cable ratings was obvious. We reported accurately, and we were right about the war. On the eve of the invasion, the New York Times editorialized that the war was reckless. The Los Angeles Times viewed it as a disaster. In the first few days of the war, both newspapers slanted their headlines in an attempt to bolster their fallacious predictions. If you were reading either of those newspapers, you would have thought the coalition was actually losing the war. The situation was so egregious that I actually got mad at the pulp fiction that was in my hands. So 3 days after the war began, I opened The Factor with a comparison of the front page headlines in the Boston Globe and the New York Times. Both are owned by the same company, but have editorial independence. The Globe's headlines were accurate. The coalition was doing well and consolidating gains. The Times headlines were exactly the opposite. I'll tell you more about this shortly. On TV, Peter Jennings, as mentioned, was openly skeptical about the war. Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw maintained their poker faces, but much of the copy they read was laced with doubt. Of course, most of that doubt evaporated 3 weeks later when Saddam's statue hit the pavement. It is my belief that the loss of credibility on the part of some major newspapers and broadcasters will be permanent. During the second week of the war, as the U.S. infantry and the Marines were driving steadily toward Baghdad, Fox News military analyst David Hunt handed me an email he had just received directly from the forward lines. It was written by an Army Lieutenant Colonel who was moving his 3rd Infantry Division at an incredible pace. Here's the pithy part of the missive. "The plan is going exactly as scripted. The news reports are full of shit. We have control of central Iraq and our casualties are light. Just today we destroyed 2 divisions and 6 other Iraqi divisions have decided not to fight. The news never reports this. We have probably killed close to 10,000. Every soldier is getting a chance to engage and kill the enemy. Iraq has these death squad guys, Fedayeen, Saddam, and they continuously make suicidal charges at our tanks, brads, and checkpoints. We are happy to send them to hell. You would not believe the carnage. Imagine your street knee-deep with body parts, with hundreds of vehicles burning, including the occupants. We fill up trucks with body parts daily." Unquote. I knew this letter was accurate and therefore also knew that many of the mainstream media reports were inaccurate. The carnage they were reporting simply did not stack up against actual coalition casualties. American and British KIA stats were extremely low, while the New York Times and others were reporting widespread fierce resistance. The LA Times was just as misleading. So I decided to call the papers on their coverage. Thank God I was right. The knockout punch to the New York Times was delivered shortly after the war began. As I mentioned, I opened the factor with a look at the front pages of the Boston Globe and the Times. Both papers have liberal editorial pages. But the Globe's page one headline suggested a war that was going fairly well in its early stages. While every single headline of the New York Times placed on page one was negative for the coalition, I asked what the hell was going on. The reaction to the comparison of the two papers was thunderous. Thousands of Americans emailed the Times with harsh complaints and copied those missives to me at the factor. Thousands of others called my radio talk show program, voicing bitter condemnation. The Times couldn't deny what its headline writers had wrought. The next day, the tone of the headlines changed dramatically. Only half of them skewed negative. It may have been a Pyrrhic victory, however. No question I severely embarrassed the New York Times and also the LA Times, which, during the 3 weeks of fighting in Iraq, ran some of the most irresponsible op-ed pieces I have ever seen. But of course there will be reprisals, because the elite media does not tolerate being held accountable. They will come after me. But I had to expose the situation. There simply wasn't a choice if I wanted to remain true to the no-spin zone philosophy. Many in the elite media were not looking out for you by inaccurately reporting what was happening in the beginning stages of the war. The headline writers and some editors were editing and slanting copy to suit their editorial feelings. This is terribly dishonest and makes me sick, so I busted them. This may sound self-congratulatory to you. If so, I'm sorry. My intent is not to put myself up as a hero. It is to report accurately what happened during the media war at home. Throughout the Iraq conflict, my analysis was mostly correct, but I did make a few mistakes. I bought the weapons of mass destruction argument too quickly and failed to predict how politicized the war would be. I should have known that the Bush administration would have to fight with one hand tied behind its back in consideration of public opinion. For that reason, the U.S. military did not utilize most of its vast power. The only thing that shocked and awed me was the misreporting I saw. In hindsight, the Pentagon's cautious strategy was understandable. The more dead Arabs lying in the sand and streets of Iraq, the greater the anger the Muslim world would feel against the USA. You will never hear the Defense Department confirm the actual total of dead Iraqi soldiers. All KIA stats will probably be classified. Truth be told, with real shock and awe, the war in Iraq could have been won in less than a week. But give the Bush administration credit. The victory was enormous on the battlefield. Coalition casualties were fewer than 150 dead, and a brutal dictator got what he deserved. The euphoria of the victory wore off quickly, however, when the weapons of mass destruction chaos kicked in. In the months after Saddam was removed, only a couple of mobile labs were found, and as you know, the anti-war crowd kicked into high gear with the Bush lied about WMDs chant. The truth about the matter is this. Mr. Bush wanted to remove Saddam, and his intelligence chieftains played to that sentiment. People like CIA Director George Tenet felt confident that because Saddam would not account for the biological weapons the UN weapons inspector said he possessed, there must be something he didn't want the world to know. This is logical thinking, and indeed, both Bill Clinton and Al Gore, as well as every congressperson on the intelligence committees, bought into that thinking. Seeking presidential approval, the intelligence agencies then dumped critical thinking and set out to prove the WMD threat. And they did come up with circumstantial evidence, supplying the Bush administration with photos and tape recordings that apparently indicated the Iraqis were hiding WMDs. That's the stuff Secretary of State Colin Powell used at his UN briefing in February 2003. The American public, jittery after 9/11, bought the perceived danger, and the game was on. It is fair to say that President Bush wanted to neutralize Saddam and found a way to make it happen. It is also fair to say that if Saddam had allowed the UN weapons inspectors full access, he might still be executing people today. Saddam defied UN mandates for years, and Bush finally called him on it. If you put ideology aside, you can see the logic of the situation. The Bush administration felt Saddam was destabilizing the Middle East and thumbing his nose at the UN. If that situation were allowed to go unchallenged, the Middle East would never calm down, and other rogue nations would also defy the United Nations. I believe Mr. Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair convinced themselves there had to be weapons of mass destruction under Saddam's control. Why else would he continue his foolish defiance? In the end, the world is a better place because Saddam was ousted, but the Bush haters and the conspiracy people have yet another scenario to keep them happy. Finally, some in the press really did look out for you. The embedded correspondents from all papers and TV networks generally reported the truth with courage and vibrance. There was a minimum of bad reporting. I was amazed at how good the information flow was, and I saw just about everything on television while reading dozens of newspapers and news magazines. These men and women in the Iraq killing field were truly magnificent. It was the ideologically blinded editors, safely ensconced back home, who performed villainous acts. One BBC correspondent actually made public a letter he sent to his London superiors demanding that they stop slanting his coverage. The reporters in the field were heroes, while the editors in the newsrooms, at least some of them, were cowards. And no, I'm not forgetting Peter Arnett. He was not an embedded reporter. He was a Baghdad guy. Arnett is a brave man, but he lost it. Saying on Iraqi TV that the coalition war plan had failed was not only stupidly wrong, it gave Saddam's killers hope and could have possibly lengthened the war. Fighters without hope usually surrender or disappear. Fighters with hope kill people. Arnett is truly the poster boy for the Stockholm Syndrome because he actually began identifying with his Baghdad handlers. I feel sorry for Peter. I wish things had turned out differently for him, I really do. At the same time, it gave me no joy to see people like Janine Garofalo, Sean Penn, Mike Farrell, Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins, Martin Sheen et al., humiliated by their chicken little opposition to the forced removal of Saddam. As I mentioned, sincere dissent should always be respected. But if you put yourself out there and you make a mistake, admit it. Don't do what the Dixie Chicks did. Don't speak provocatively about a subject you don't know anything about, and then claim, well, I have the freedom to say what I want. That's true, but that's stupid. Natalie Maines is not going for her PhD in political science anytime soon. The Chicks' lead singer does have a right to spout off about any subject, no question, but if she offends millions by insulting the president during wartime, and then can't explain the origins of her dissatisfaction about the war, as she couldn't when Diane Sawyer interviewed her, she's going to look foolish and perhaps venal. The result will be that some fans will no longer support her commercial enterprises. That's life in the controversial lane. Remember, the Constitution gives you the right to be a moron, and millions of us exercise that right all the time. But sometimes there's a price to be paid. Finally, the war in Iraq proves once again that ideologues can never look out for you. They are too blinded by the light on the right or the left, and they will never see things for what they really are. If you become an ideological prisoner, the truth will always elude you because you will never seek it. Instead, you'll evaluate each issue and problem with an agenda, trying to prove your ideology is correct. The anecdote to this is to reject a rigid political philosophy and discipline yourself to think logically. Gather facts. Facts always look out for you. And that's a fact. Chapter 7. You have the right to remain silent. I shot the sheriff, but I did not shoot the deputy. Bob Marley, I shot the sheriff. There is a simple reason that the average American lawyer makes $90,000 a year, and that's because any kind of legal situation will cost you dearly, both financially and emotionally. Once again, here is the blunt truth. The so-called justice system in America is not looking out for you, and you should write that down and read it every day for the rest of your life. If you are poor and you are arrested, things will get very bad very soon. If you have money, justice might come around a bit quicker, but you will find yourself writing enormous checks on a regular basis. Lawyers charge by the hour, and at $400 per, just saying, hi there, Perry Mason, will cost you $10. Generally speaking, however, any kind of legal problem is going to remove assets from your possession, so think very hard before misbehaving or suing somebody for throwing trash on your lawn. Even the contingency crowd, lawyers who charge only if they win a settlement, may peck you to death with expenses. The American justice system is a runaway money train where those without legal credentials are tied to the tracks. The reality is that judges and lawyers and cops and everybody else in the law business belong to a club. And that club wants you to pay the dues but not become a member. Deals are made all the time in the club. Lawyers and judges often know each other, have relationships, and for one reason or another, have a vested interest in seeing the club prosper. You, the American citizen, are just passing through the club and will not even be offered valet parking. And the club is doing very, very well. From 1984 to 99, criminal cases rose 47% and civil cases 32% in state courts across the country, according to the National Center for Tort Reform. Everybody involved in the legal system is making money, except those whom the system is supposedly designed to protect. No matter how you get involved in the legal system, you will pay. Trust me on this. Since I can't stand the unfairness of the legal world and even get stomach aches writing about it, this chapter will be very short. But I want to give you a vivid example of how corrupt the American legal system has become and how it most definitely does not look out for you or any other non-member. Remember that brutal murder of 7-year-old Danielle Van Dam in San Diego? She was snatched out of her house while her parents were smoking pot and her father was fooling around with one of his wife's friends. The couple had a self-admitted open marriage. Anyway, little Danielle was brutally raped and murdered and buried in a desert. Immediately under suspicion in the case was a neighbor of the Van Dams, a middle-aged guy named David Westerfield. The man was a perverted creep. Child pornography was found on computer disks in his office. Almost at once, the cops knew he did it. But Danielle's body could not be found, making a provable case very difficult. The police, however, did have evidence that Danielle had been in Westerfield's presence. The little girl's hair, blood, and fingerprints were found in Westerfield's motorhome. Other hairs from Danielle were found on his bed. As the evidence mounted against Westerfield, his attorneys, Stephen Feldman and Robert Boyce, began actively negotiating a plea bargain with authorities. The San Diego Union-Tribune reported the situation. Quote, "Minutes before Danielle Van Dam's remains were found on February 27, 2002, David Westerfield's lawyers were brokering a deal with prosecutors. He would tell police where he dumped the little girl's body. They would not seek the death penalty. Prosecutors were seriously considering the bargain when Danielle's body was discovered. The deal was just minutes away, one of the sources said. But after the body was discovered, the lawyers no longer had anything to discuss regarding a plea bargain," unquote. And so the case went to trial, but by law, any discussions of the plea deal were not admissible in court. Even the judge was not aware of the proposed plea bargain. But Westerfield's lawyers obviously knew their client was guilty because they offered the location of the body. Nevertheless, during the trial, Feldman and Boyce mounted a defense based partly on the unprovable and completely immoral theory that acquaintances of the Van Dams, who were in the house on the night the girl disappeared, could have been the killers. In the process, these defense lawyers destroyed the reputations of the Van Dams, who were still grieving for their little daughter. Unbelievable. The only active participants in any criminal trial who are not under oath are the attorneys and the judge, so the attorneys can say anything they want to say. But there are rules against lying or intentionally misleading the jury, and they are supposed to be enforced. I said they are supposed to be. In reality, there is little enforcement against unethical conduct by defense attorneys. As I'll tell you in a moment, Feldman and Boyce knowingly misled the jury and got away with it. But their client, thank God, did not. Despite the actions of Westerfield's lawyers, he was convicted by a jury and sentenced to death. The physical evidence presented by the prosecution was overwhelming and finally did the killer in. He's still on death row awaiting execution, but after the trial, I told some of the jurors about the proposed deal Feldman and Boyce had reportedly offered. They were stunned. One juror, Raymond Witkowski, said that he could not believe the lawyers had attempted to mislead the jury and in the process smeared the reputations of the Van Dams. On September 18, 2002, I interviewed Mr. Witkowski on The Factor. O'Reilly. Now, when you were listening to Feldman paint a scenario that Danielle Van Damme's parents might have been responsible for her death by allowing strangers to come into the home, the lawyer was believable, wasn't he? Winkowski. Oh, yeah, he was very believable. O'Reilly. And the jury took his scenario seriously? Winkowski. Oh, yes, he impressed us a lot. O'Reilly. But now that you find out that Feldman made it all up, that he knew his client was guilty because, according to the Tribune, he offered a deal, what do you think? Winkowski. I don't see how anyone could do that. I really do not. Rule 5200 of the California Bar Rules of Conduct states, quote, a lawyer shall not seek to mislead the judge, judicial officer, or jury by an artifice or false statement of law or fact. An artifice means a fabricated action or account. In my opinion, Feldman and Boyce clearly violated Rule 5200. But did the California Bar do anything about it? No, it did not. After the interview with Raymond Winkowski aired, the Factor and hundreds of our viewers filed complaints against the two attorneys. The California Bar was inundated. And so was I, as hundreds of letters from attorneys around the country arrive chastising me for my criticism. San Diego criminal defense attorney William Nemo came on the Factor and said this to me, quote, I don't think you understand the duty of a defense lawyer. Our job, regardless of what we know, regardless of what our client knows, is to put forth a vigorous defense, which means cross-examining witnesses even we know are truthful, putting up scenarios we know might not even be correct, unquote. In other words, Counselor Nemo is saying that any kind of fabrication is fine as long as it's used in a, quote, vigorous defense, unquote. I challenged him on it, asking, are you denying they lied? Quote, I'm not denying that they maybe put up a defense they didn't believe in, Nemo shot back. They lied, counselor, I said. That's their duty and their obligation. Are you shocked by Nemo's stance? If so, you must have missed the O.J. Simpson trial. Anything goes in court these days, and the cleverest, not the most honest, lawyers usually win. This is justice? This is the whole truth and nothing but the truth? If witnesses, investigators, and defendants have to tell the truth, you're telling me lawyers don't? That's exactly what the justice system is saying. And the result is that killers, rapists, dope dealers, and other dangerous individuals are put right back out on the streets, even as the lawyers cash their checks. Luckily for society, but no thanks to his devious lawyers, David Westerfield will get what he deserves. But little solace can be taken from that, because if his lawyers had been successful with their sleazy ruse, a child killer would have escaped the death penalty. It has happened before. On February 19, 2003, the Factor received a letter from the chief trial counsel of the State Bar of California, Mike Nisperos Jr., which said in part, quote, after reviewing the relevant portions of the court transcript, we determined that the conduct of Mr. Feldman and Mr. Boyce was within the scope of historical and ethical parameters of practice by a criminal defense attorney. In the opinion of the trial court, the trial district attorney, and this office, there is no basis to support any charge of misconduct, unquote. One problem with the contents of that letter. The San Diego district attorney who prosecuted Westerfield, Paul Pfingst, came on the Factor and said no one at the California Bar had ever contacted him, and had someone done so, he would have told them that the conduct of Feldman and Boyce violated a number of ethical canons. The bar covered up for Westerfield's lawyers. We immediately refiled a complaint. But I don't expect any satisfaction here. The club almost always sticks together. The fact that Mr. Pfingst came forward publicly is very unusual. He will probably lose his club privileges for a while. Let's sum up the prosecution's case in this matter. The defense attorneys for child killer David Westerfield were cleared of any and all wrongdoing, even though they knowingly fabricated a false scenario to try to get this monster set free. And that's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God. Our justice system is overburdened, driven by money and connections, and sometimes downright corrupt, and few in power seem to care. The Factor was the only news organization that condemned Feldman and Boyce, who are not alone in their actions. Where was the rest of the media? This is a disgraceful situation and one that should be addressed by the Supreme Court immediately. But it won't be, because the Supreme Court justices are not proactive. They are like lizards sunning on a rock. They don't move unless something comes along. The lawyer lobby in this country is too rich and too powerful. Too much money is made every day from legal sleight of hand and outright deception for any meaningful reform to take place. Ask any police officer what he or she thinks of defense techniques in general. All of them will tell you horror stories. Americans like to think that our country is a place where all citizens can get a fair trial before a jury of our peers. But if lawyers are allowed to deceive, fabricate, smear, and intimidate without consequence, where is the fairness? Our criminal justice system has become a farce where high-priced lawyers, armed with vivid imaginations, run wild. And the civil courts are even worse, with many cases taking years even to be heard, while legal expenses mount astronomically. So, if you possibly can, stay away from all this. It is a cesspool of corruption. Even if you win, you'll get hurt. I love this country, but I despise what our so-called justice system has degenerated into. If you're an unscrupulous lawyer, the system looks out for you. If you are looking for an honest day in court, well, you have my sympathy, because you are not likely to get it. Chapter 8, Minority Report. Why do I find it hard to write the next line? Oh, I want the truth to be said. Spandau Ballet, true. I know this much to be true. It's not easy being a minority in the United States. Not only are you outnumbered, but the crushing weight of irrational ignorance is, generally speaking, directed toward you far more than it is at the majority. Sometimes whites in the USA overlook racial bias entirely because it does not affect them. For example, I recently reported the story of an all-white high school prom that was being held in rural Georgia. It was obviously exclusionary, but also totally unnecessary. Taylor County High, a school that is equally divided between blacks and whites, had scheduled a prom for everybody, so there was no apparent need for the segregated version. And nobody put forth a good reason for holding it. I blasted the prom, figuring that after 9/11 and the Iraq War, where about 20% of the casualties were African American, there would be a huge outrage against this kind of insult. I was wrong. Instead of condemnation, I heard a litany of excuses from school officials and talk show bloviators. The Republican governor of Georgia, Sonny Perdue, ran for cover, refusing to issue direct statements about the event. Perdue actually sent his black press secretary to confront me on the factor where, predictably, she got hammered in the debate after she claimed the governor was too busy to address the issue. And that wasn't hard to do because an all-white high school dance is indefensible in a country named the United States. I told the governor's press lady that the prom was hurtful of black students attending Taylor High and that Perdue had a leadership obligation to scorn the event, but he would not. So it is undeniable that white leadership on racial questions is often lacking, but so too is black leadership. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton were nowhere to be found during the prom controversy, and the black legislators on Capitol Hill were also missing in action. Maybe they don't consider an incident like this important, but they are also mostly silent on black crime, horrendous rap lyrics, and the disintegration of the African-American family. It doesn't take John Schaff to figure out there is a lack of national leadership in the minority community because, inexplicably, the big picture eludes many so-called minority spokespeople. And more than a few national minority leaders are really demagogues who feed their followers lies and deceptions in order to accumulate money and power. I'm sometimes asked why I do so much reporting and analysis of minority issues, and my reply is brief, because few others do, and all Americans deserve equal justice and a fair chance at the pursuit of happiness. The elite media are literally scared speechless of offending minorities in America and thus shy away from most confrontational reporting on situations that injure those who do not have the resources to fight effectively for themselves. For all of the politically correct rhetoric you hear or read in the press, little is actually being done to right wrongs in the tough side of town. Chances are you have never heard of the Englewood neighborhood on the infamous south side of Chicago unless you're a jazz fan. During Chicago's jazz age, the area was vibrant and safe, but now it is a terrifying place for the people who live there, marked by vacant lots and boarded-up storefronts that, at night, house dangerous people. In the past 10 years, about 700 people have been murdered in this area, which spans just 4 square miles and has a population of 100,000 mostly poor and working class people. The problem in Englewood is a drug gang called the Gangster Disciples. They kill and terrorize law-abiding Americans to protect their lucrative turf. Authorities estimate the gang reaps about $1 million a week from selling narcotics. The gang employs hundreds of residents, mostly teenagers, to move the poison and watch for police. The action is round the clock and never ends. Of course, the Chicago authorities know this, and so do the federal drug agencies. But the situation is allowed to exist. The same scenario would not be acceptable in Malibu, in Georgetown, in the Hamptons, or on Park Avenue. Drug gangs would not be permitted to stand in front of million-dollar homes selling illegal substances. Many cops would arrive and forcibly remove said dealers if they ever tried it, which they wouldn't. But on the south side of Chicago, and in thousands of other similar neighborhoods across the USA, the brutal hoods can do pretty much what they want. That is not equal justice under the law. Some believe that skin color is the reason that the authorities allow inner-city chaos, but that's not the reason. As I wrote in my book, The O'Reilly Factor, this is about class, not race. While racial bigots do exist, they are far less influential and effective than they used to be in America. Racism is death in corporate